All right, this week's Sefer is Parashat Bo. I would say that the story of Parashat Bo is a story of transformation. It's the story of transition. It is the parasha in which the dramatic change is going to take place, not only in the history of the Jewish people, but a great blow is going to be struck by God on behalf of the freedom of all men throughout all of history. There is a principle that's going to be established for all time. Major principles are not accomplished overnight, but there's a process. And what I want to do this morning is, by dealing with a number of issues in the parasha, I want to trace the transition. And what's fascinating is there are two transformations taking place at one and the same time. As the Jewish people are moving from slavery to freedom, Paro and Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, are moving in the opposite direction, from their independence into a situation of slavery and bondage. Each one is moving in a different direction. Here it is, the great mighty empire of Egypt is in the process of crumbling, while what will be Klal Yisrael is in the process of emerging to the light of day, as that great power of the ancient world is falling into ruins. From those ruins will emerge an eternal people. And I want to trace with you the changes, the emotional changes, the intellectual changes that take place both in Paro and Mitzrayim on the one hand, and the Jewish people on the other. Let's begin with the first pasuk. The first pasuk of the parash is one of those pasukim that brings to the fore a question that is asked by all of the mafarshim. Everybody's concerned with it. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, God said to Moshe, Bo el Paro, come to Paro, ki ani hirvadeti et libo, because I have hardened or made heavy his heart, that lev avadav, the heart of the servants, l'man shiti otel tai eila b'kirbo, in order that I should place my signs in him, l'man tesapet yozei bincho ben bincho, in order that you should be able to tell the ears of your children and your grandchildren, eit asher hit alalti b'mitzchayim, what I did to Egypt, that otel tai asher samti b'ame, and the signs that I placed in them, b'yedatem, and you should know, ki ani Hashem, that I am God. The problem that arises out of this pasuk, as a number of psukim in Parashat Va'era, same problem. What is it that defines man? What is it that makes man different than all other creatures on the face of this earth? What is it that's so unique and so special about man? The fact that he has free will. He's not a robot. Man is not a puppet. Man is not determined by anything outside of himself. We don't believe that there's somebody pulling strings somewhere and that a person must do certain things in life. This flies in the face of all of Torah. The very fact that there is a God who commands and he rewards and he punishes must of necessity mean that man has the free will to do or not to do. To do mitzvot or to sin. He can do whatever he wants. And it's because he can do whatever he wants that he therefore is called to account. If a person is determined, if there's somebody pulling the strings, if man is no more than a robot, if there's shilut rachok, shilut rachok, what's that? I forget already how you say it even. Remote control, I can say it in English, shilut rachok, all right. Remote control. That's it, sholeit, one in a sense controls the situation, made achok, from the distance. Man is not moved by remote control. So what are we supposed to do here? God has hardened the heart of Paro. Hashofet kol haaretz, lo yasa mishpat, isn't that what Avram said? The judge of the whole earth shall not do justice. This is unjust. First of all, to remove his free will, and then to go ahead, after you have removed his free will, you're yet going to punish him. Ki ani hirvadeti et libo, I have hardened his heart, in order that I should be able to do all of these terrible things to him.
Well, not fair. It's not divine. The Rambam, of course, is the one who establishes this this principle very, very clearly. And the Rambam says, "Ve'ein lo la'adam mi sheyichpehu." Man doesn't have anyone who coerces him. V'lo gozer alav. There's nobody who decrees on him. V'lo misha moshcho le'echad mishnei hadvarim. There's nobody drawing him to any one of the two sides, either to good or to evil. Elohu me'atzmo u'me'dato. Man, from himself, and by virtue of his own intellect, notel le'ezer derech sheyirtzeh. He can move himself whichever direction he wants. And this is an extremely great and important principle of our faith. It's the pillar upon which Torah and Mitzvot stand. Something happened to that pillar here. And furthermore, poor Paro. He's going to be punished for something that he no longer has control of. So there are a number of approaches. One of the approaches, of course, is the approach of the Rambam, which also is the approach of Rashi. The Rambam says, "Sukim har beyesh b'Torah b'divrei hanaviim." There are many passages in Torah and in the words of the prophets, "Shein nidim kisotrim ikar zeh," that seem to stand in contrast to this fundamental principle that I've just enunciated. V'nichsholim v'hen rov ha'adam. Most people stumble; they don't know how to deal with it. V'yal al datan, and it will even occur to some people, Shakodish Baruch Hu gozer al ha'adam la'asot ra'ah tovah. There are people who may even be left with the impression that God decrees upon man to do good or evil. V'ein she'en libo shel adam osur lo, that the heart of man is not in his hands to do whatever he wants. So the Rambam says, I am now going to tell you another important principle. And the principle is the following. It's possible that a man is going to sin a great sin, or he's going to do many sins, and the punishment for that sin is, or for those sins will be, shemonin mimenu hatshuva, that tshuva is removed from him. The ability and the possibility of doing tshuva is removed from him. It means that a person may very well sin and continue to sin and do terrible things, commit horrible crimes, and to the point that the punishment is the removal of free will. The removal of free will, so that he shouldn't be able to do tshuva. What it really means is you have abused the great gift that God gave you. Man has free will. You've abused it. You've used it time and time again to do evil. Therefore, we're now going to strip you of your humanity, the humanity which you already stripped yourself of by your own free will. You used free will and choice in order to inflict pain, punishment upon others. So therefore, the Rambam says, yes, it's absolutely just that God removes his free will and then punishes him. And the removal of the free will in and of itself is punishment. In a sense, even if it does not come as a direct act from God, isn't that what man does whenever he commits an avera time and time again? What happens is, the avera is no longer an avera. He has lost the sensitivity to it. He really has removed his own free will by free will. He chose not to be able to choose anymore. He has made the evil part of his consciousness, and he did it by virtue of his own free will. This is the approach of the Rambam. That's right, a drug addict, or a person who is addicted to Lashon Hara, or to Rechilas. People can be addicted to Sinas Chinam. People can become addicted to all sorts of things. So that means, in the final analysis, the person doesn't have choice anymore. Doesn't have choice. So God is saying, listen, you have sinned so terribly, you lose your ability to choose freedom. That's one approach. There's another approach, and this is the approach of the Ramban. The approach of the Ramban is, round about now, beginning of Parashat Bo. Beginning of Parashat Bo means that we finished Va'era. In Va'era, there were already 7 plagues that were brought upon Paro. 7 plagues. By the end of Parashat Va'era, he already says, you know, God is right and I am a sinner. God is right. That means he's already in the process, it would seem, he is already in the process of tshuva. Why does God harden his heart now? So the Ramban says God hardens his heart not in order to remove free will from him, on the contrary, to give him free will. Because what's he ready to do now? Right now he's ready to throw in the towel, give up. He can't take the pain, the suffering. The plagues have done their job. So why is he ready now to say, okay, go? Or why is he ready to say now that he's wrong? Is it because of an inner conviction that there is a God who is creator, who intervenes in history? Is it because he believes firmly now that man is really created, all men are created equal, and therefore it's been a terrible crime all of these years, enslaving other people? Is that why he is ready to buckle under now? Absolutely not. He's ready to throw in the towel simply because he can't take it anymore. It hurts, absolutely. He can't take it anymore. Would that be an act of free will? That means, number one, he would be doing it because he has been coerced by the plagues. And that would not have accomplished what God wants to accomplish in terms of educating Paro. Because, listen, it hurts, okay? Go. What God wants is to give him the strength and the courage and the ability to withstand the plagues. And if he has that strength, there's a return of a balance in the life of Paro. All the klep that he's received, all of the plagues, would move him now to let them go, but for the wrong reason. The reason would be the plagues. The reason would be that he's suffering. That's not really an act of free will. That's not achieving and accomplishing a knowledge of God, and that slavery is wrong and man is free. What God wants is to give Paro another chance, another opportunity to choose freely. And the only way he does that is by giving him strength, giving him a tough heart. He's able to take it all, which means God is returning the balance. So on the contrary, that which seems to us as though God is dealing unjustly with Paro, it's precisely the opposite. This is justice. Let him still retain the ability to choose freely, even under the most horrible of conditions. There's a third approach. The third approach is an approach I found in the Shem Yishmuel, the Sachet Shava. You've heard already this year a few times on the Shem Yishmuel. He says it in the name of his father, who was the Avnei Nezer. He says that the Egyptians were an extremely sensual people. They responded to physical stimuli because they were physical people, an earthy people. People who are extremely involved with themselves physically are unable to suffer terribly long. What they need is, they need to be graced with the gift of intellect and intelligence. When God intervenes, in a sense, in the mind of Paro, his servants, and all of Egypt, the Avnei Nezer sees it as God granting him a gift to remove them or raise them from their physical attributes, their being so physical, and raising them to an intellectual level. In a sense, God is giving them a much profounder ability to think, so that he should learn something. What does Paro do? He uses this gift and he chooses he chooses evil rather than good. If I'm to sum them up, it would mean that the approach of Rashi and the Rambam is that the hardening of the heart of Paro is punishment. You deserve it. So long you chose the wrong thing, now we have the right to remove your free will. And of course that fits in very well with the fact that during the course of the first five Makot, it never says that God hardened the heart of Paro. It's only from Makot number 6 and further that it says that God intervenes. The first five plagues, it was Paro himself who hardened and strengthened his heart. It's only after the first five that God says, that's it, I had enough. Now I'm removing your ability to choose freely. Rashi says that in Parsha Feira, and you see it in the Pesukim. It's only from Makos 6 and further. So the Rambam and Rashi see it as the removal of free will as punishment. The hardening of the heart, which is the removal of free will, as punishment. The Ramban sees the hardening of the heart of Paro, on the contrary, as an antidote to the Makos. He would be ready to cave in because of the plagues. We have to give him the ability to think freely. It's the antidote. According to the Avnei Nezer, it is a gift. God grants Paro and Mitzrayim a divine gift, taking an extremely physical and sensual people and raising them to a level of intellect, and they goof that too. Even that, they use in an evil manner. The Shem Yishmuel, the son of the Avnei Nezer, makes a very, very beautiful comment. He says that if we're going to look through these Parshat Va'eda and Parshat Bo, we're going to see that there are three terms used by the Torah to describe God's intervention in the consciousness of Paro. One is the term chizuk va'ani achazek, I will strengthen the heart of Paro, va'yechazak Paro et libo, he strengthened his heart. The other is kishui va'ani aksheh, I will harden the heart of Paro. And the other is the term that we have here, ki ani hichbadeti et libo. Three terms. Chazak, chazak, strength, strengthen. Kishui, I would say, is harden, and lahachbid is to make heavy. And he says that each one of them represents something else that happened to Paro, because there's a process that he's going through. And if you will, let's have it correspond to the world of Chassidut. Man is made up of three parts. Man is guf, he's physical; nefesh, emotional; seichel, intellectual. Those are the three parts that make up man. He's physical, he's emotional, he's intellectual. Guf, nefesh, seichel. At different stages in the metamorphosis of Paro, or let us say better, the downfall of Paro, there were different aspects of his personality and his being that he affected, and that were therefore affected by God. The word Ba'ani Aksheh, God says, I will strengthen, Lahakshot, means to be firm and to be strong, to make a decision and stick to it. It can even be, and very often is, a positive quality. Klal Yisrael are the ones who have kashyut oref, kishay oref, stiff-necked, strong. To be kashe means not somebody who can be easily swayed. One makes an intellectual decision and sticks by it. Chazak represents the emotional fear. You know, we're frightened. We can be intellectually strong, but we're frightened. We're afraid of pain. We're afraid of suffering. when it says that he was chazak, chazak is the opposite of cowardly or frightened. Emotionally also he has to be strong. And then even the person who is intellectually determined, emotionally strong, it reaches a point where the pain is just too much. Physically, emotionally, I know how I feel. Intellectually, I know what I believe. I just can't take it anymore. Physically, I can't take it anymore. That's Vani Hichbadeti at Libo. At the beginning of this week's Sedra, it means, therefore, that Paro has already gone through a transformation. Intellectually, he knows the truth already. He knows the truth. His servants are going to tell him, "Aterem teda, don't you know, ki of the Mitzrayim, that Mitzrayim is lost? Don't you know that it's all over?" He emotionally, he knows the truth. He would be ready to give in. Why would he be ready to give in? He's ready. He would be ready to give in simply because he can't take the pain anymore. Ki ani hirbadeti et libo. I have the kaved, the heaviness, represents the ability of the body to take it. Maybe to the extent that a heaviness of the body represents the idea that there are no feelings, none. Exactly. Yechibadeti at libo, physically numb. He doesn't feel anymore. He doesn't feel anymore. And each one of the three approaches that we mentioned before correspond to these three different terms. What were the three approaches? We had the Ramban who said that the hardening of the heart of Paro, or the strengthening of his heart, the Ramban is the one who says that it's in order to return to him his ability to choose freely. That represents the idea of emotionally, sensually, he has to be free. The approach of the Ramban and Rashi that says the man sinned so much, God will remove from him the ability to choose. That represents the fact that he's unfeeling anymore. Harchabadat halei. The Avnei Nezer who said that God granted him a gift of intellect and he abused it. So it means that what God did for him was ani achazek, I'm going to give strength and determination to the heart of Pharaoh so that he should be able to make the proper intellectual decision, and then he goes ahead and he uses that gift, he abuses it completely. So we're watching a change, a metamorphosis that's taking place in Paro, physically, emotionally, intellectually. He continues to maintain his stance of rebellion against God. And as a result, of course, he is beginning to fall deeper and deeper. What's going to happen now is, let's see what's going to happen to Klal Yisrael. What's going to happen to Klal Yisrael? So it says, we'll read from the parasha. We finally arrive in Parashat Bo, we arrive at that part of Torah that Rashi at the very beginning of Torah said, Lo hayat zorech lahatchilet haTorah lemi haChodesh hazeh lochem. Torah should have begun with the pasuk of haChodesh hazeh lochem, this month shall be unto you the first of months, the first mitzvah that the Jewish people are commanded. So watch what happens here in this first mitzvah. Jewish people are told that God is going to come down the night of the 15th of Nisan, and he is going to destroy all of the firstborn in Egypt, and they have to take a seh, and they're to slaughter it. Chapter 12. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe v'al Aaron, God said to Moshe and to Aaron in the land of Egypt, so saying, HaChodesh hazeh lachem, this month shall be unto you Rosh Chodoshim, the first of months, Rishon hu lachem, the Chodesh Hashanah. It's the first. First of the months of the year, Dabru, speak El Kol Adat Yisrael, Lemo, speak to the entire congregation of Israel, saying, Be'osa l'chodesh hazeh, the tenth day of this month, V'yikhu lehem ish sel beit avot sel abayit. Each man shall take unto himself a sheep for every family, a sheep for every house. And Pasuk Dalet tells us that if there aren't enough people to eat a shep challah in one house, so you can join together with your neighbor. Pasuk 6 says it, you shall hold it until the 14th day of this month. Shachatu al to kol kehalatat Yisrael beinu abayim, and the entire congregation of the children of Israel shall slaughter it on the 14th day. A change is in the process of taking place in the consciousness of the Jewish people. There are a number of terms by which the Jewish people are described. A community is described by a number of terms. One of the terms is machaneh, a camp. Another term is the term eidah. Isn't that what Pasuk 3 says? Dabru el kol adat Yisrael, emo, speak to the entire eidah, the congregation. There's a third term. The third term is kahal. Kihilah, kihilot ha-kodesh. I want to deal with two of them now for a few moments, eidah and kahal. Machaneh, in a sense, falls into a different category. Machaneh always represents a community that is joined together by fear of a common enemy on the outside. A machaneh are those who join together a camp because there's something to be frightened out of out there, and it is in our joint common interest that we together fight off the enemy from without. The machaneh is not necessarily a cohesive unit from within. What holds the machaneh together is the threat on from the outside. Listen, if the Chinese communists and the Chinese nationalists joined together during the Second World War, it was in order to deal with the yellow peril, the Japanese, as soon as the war was over. And there are always common interests. Lahavdil, a coalition government in the state of Israel. Singly or separately, but they are joined together by a common interest. Offices, funds, car, driver, telephone, funds, telephone, funds, yes. Power, position, prominence. So there are common interests, and the common interest, therefore, it's a matter of you get the covered wagons, and we're going to keep out. We're going to keep out the enemy from without. The tragedy, of course, is in the blessing lies the tragedy. Once the enemy from without is gone, then the unity from within disintegrates completely. In a sense, that's the difference between a Jew whose devotion to Judaism is the result of the fact that he believes in Torah and he performs mitzvot, and the Jew who maintains his identity because of anti-Semitism. Whereas anti-Semitism has been a strong force in Jewish identity, but it's a negative one. It's one that comes from without and not the one that comes from within. The Jew who believes, the Jew who performs is the one who is Jew from within. Even if there wouldn't be anti-Semitism in the world, he'd remain a Jew. But we're not going to deal with machaneh. What's the difference between kohol and eidah? Eidah. In Torah, we find the term eidah used in a number of very, very unique places. The meraglim, the spies who come back and give the evil report about Eretz Yisrael, are called adat meraglim, the eidah of the meraglim. Korach, Malka, Meretov. Korach, Vadato, the congregation of Korach, those who rebel against Moshe, they are referred to as an eidah. Which means that the The Torah says you shall not be kikorach va'adato like Korach and his congregation. He bodlu Moshe says he bodlu mitocha edo haroa hazot, remove yourself from this evil congregation. The word eda can be used in a negative way, and it is used in a negative way. It could be positive. The word kahal is never used in a negative sense. Kahal, the Gemara talks often about kahala kedisha to Yerushalayim, the holy community of Yerushalayim. What do we say on davening on Shabbos? Let God bless this entire holy community. What's the difference between Eida and Kahal? The difference between Eida and Kahal is how the individual sees himself within the community. There are different ways in which individuals react and respond or act within a community setting. You will have the individual who feels that I don't have to be involved. There are better people than me out there, people with more talent, with more time. I'm not needed in the overall framework of the community. Who needs me? Others will do it. That's the individual who in a sense remains silent. He remains a spectator and a witness. And there are other people who make sure that their voice must be heard. There's no such thing as sitting back and doing nothing. Person who's a member of a community has to act. He has to speak out. He has to say something. He has to make his voice heard. He has to be an active part of a kehila. The word eida. What word do you hear in the term eida? What do you aid? Aid. What is an aid? An aid is a witness. In halacha, what is it that's extremely important? An aid is somebody who dare not be involved in what's taking place. He must be completely passive and objective. The witness who stands on the side and watches, not at all involved. In the word kahol, you know what you hear in the word kahol? What do you hear? What kol do you hear in the word kahal? The word kol. Okay. In other words, what's the color of Washington's white horse? What kol do you hear in the word kahal? You hear the sound kol, the voice. The voice of the individual is heard within the context of kahal. The difference between eida and kahal, therefore, an eida is a witnessing community. An eida is a passive community. Now that can be negative or positive. As Klal Yisrael stands at the foothills of Mount Sinai, they are the Eidah who are listening to the words of God. God is active and they are passive. They're the witnesses. Then there are times, of course, that Eidah may very well be extremely negative nature. When both by Adat HaMeraglim and Adat Korach, means the rest of Klal Yisrael remained passive. They remained passive. Not good. The true Jewish community is a Jewish community that is an active one. Eida is the passive witnessing community. Kahal is the active community, the one in which the voice of the individual is heard. And maybe the voices of many individuals, but the voices of many individuals who are speaking the same language, it becomes a symphony of voices. Watch the transformation that begins. The transformation that begins on the 14th day of the month of Nisan that year in Egypt. In Pasuk 3 it says, Dabru el kol adat Yisrael lemor, speak to the entire Eida of Israel, telling them on the 10th day of this month you should take the sheep, hold it until the 14th. But take a look at what it says in Pasuk 6. For Hoyolachem Mishmeret, you should hold on to that Shepsal until the 14th day of this month. Vishachatu alto kol kahal Adat Yisrael. The entire kehila of Adat Yisrael should slaughter it by virtue of the fact that on Erev Pesach, Erev, that great Pesach, they slaughtered the Korban Pesach. What's happening is an Eidah, a passive witnessing community, has been transformed into an active community. The Eidah turns into Kohol, because for the first time in 210 years, they are beginning to take their destiny in their own hands. They're doing something. They're not merely the Eda. When he speaks to them, he says, speak to the Eda. Speak to a community that really has remained silent all of these years, a community that hasn't been able to do anything for themselves. God says, I am now going to make them into participants in the act of their own freedom. And they're going to become a kohol on the 14th day of Nisan. When they slaughter the Korban Pesach, that's the beginning. They're finally acting. They have their voice back. They have their voice back. There is a Zohar that says that before Moshe Rabbeinu came, there was silence. There was no voice. When Moshe came, there was a voice. When Jews went out of Egypt, the word. Jews had been so beaten down that they remained silent. The most that would come out of them was the groan, the ache of pain. But they weren't able to express themselves. It's only now, as they begin to take their destiny in their own hands, that they become transformed into a kohol. There's a voice. You can hear something. They're saying something. They're speaking with action, which is even stronger than words. But there's another transformation that takes place. Next transformation that takes place is most probably the one that is going to be most important for all of history. We sit down at the night of the Seder. At the Seder we say, Amar Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Gamliel said, Kol Shelo Amar Shlosha Devarim Elu Pesach, whoever didn't say these three things on Pesach, Lo Yotze Yedei Chovato, has not fulfilled his responsibility. What are these three things? Pesach, Matzah, and Morah. So we say matzah zu, this matzah that we eat is because we went out of Mitzrayim in great haste and the dough didn't rise. Morar zeh, this morar that we eat, the bitter herbs, is because of the bitterness of Egypt. Pesach, so since we don't have a carbon Pesach today, so we say Pesach that our fathers used to eat at the time of the Beit HaMikdash was because God passed over our homes. At the time of the Beit HaMikdash, they would take a look at the Korban Pesach that was there on the table, and they would say, Pesach zeh, this Korban Pesach is because God, he passed over our homes when he smote the Egyptians. Let me ask you, what did Jews say when they sat down to the Seder in Mitzrayim that night? What did they say that night? At the stroke of midnight, God said he's going to come through Egypt and kill the firstborn. Freedom is going to come at the stroke of midnight. But they're sitting down, they have a Korban Pesach already. So what do you do with the Korban Pesach? Do you know what they said? Pesach Zeshon, open this Pesach that we're eating, this Korban Pesach is because we believe with perfect faith that another few hours from now, God is going to redeem us. What Jews are really doing the night of Pesach in Mitzrayim, they are celebrating their independence and their freedom even before it's happened. They're still enslaved, they are still under the rule of Paro, but they believe now with perfect faith that the redemption is going to come. In a sense, they may have sung Ani Mamin Be'emunah Shleima, I believe with perfect faith in the coming of Hashem, 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 he's going to come at the stroke of midnight. They believe it. What's being established by Klal Yisrael that night is that throughout history they are going to have trust, confidence, and faith in redemption even before it comes. And what therefore is able to sustain them throughout history is this ability to be able, in the midst of darkness at night, they're able to see that there's going to be a greater day. That's why we survive. And that principle was established that night. They are celebrating the Exodus from Egypt before the Exodus even began. It's faith, confidence, trust. I'm going to take you on a little journey. And in this little journey, we're going to see again the idea of the transformation, what's taking place in Klal Yisrael. So first of all, what we've described is they have become from Eidah, they have become Kohol. That happens already Erev Pesach in the afternoon. that night of Pesach, they become a faith community, a community that has trust and confidence in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They establish within the consciousness of their people for all time that we will believe in a greater tomorrow for our whole world, even though it doesn't seem so right now, but it's going to happen. We believe it. Which means that we insist that there is a goal to history, there's an objective, it's going someplace, and where it's going to is going to be the greater glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'olu Moshiim V'har Tzion L'shvat Et Ha'Esav. We believe it. There will be an end to darkness, there's going to be an end to slavery. I want to take on a little journey that Rav Meir Simcha, Meshech Chachma. If you haven't heard a Meshech Chachma from me already for a long time, I'm long, long overdue on a Meshech Chachma. But this is going to be a quick journey through a major part of Torah. Major part of Torah. Just hang in there with me. Hang in there with me. The journey is going to begin right here in Parashat Bo. In the command, a few psukim later, we are in chapter 12. We were at pasuk 6. First great transformation takes place in pasuk 6. The next dramatic change, the change that's going to make all the difference in the world throughout all of history, comes in psukim 9 and 10. Don't even try to figure out how. In pasuk 9 it says, "Al tochlu mimenu na," don't eat raw, u'bashel levushal b'mayim, or that which is cooked in water. You can't eat the korban pesach if it's cooked or raw. Kiyim tzli esh, rosho al kara'ov al kirbo. It has to be roasted, a whole shepsala. Can't have lamb chops. It has to be a whole lamb, a whole shepsala. And the next pasuk, v'lo totinu mimenu adboka, and don't leave anything over until morning. V'hanotam mimenu adboka, whatever you leave until morning, ba'esh tisrofu, by the time dawn comes, by the dawn's early light, whatever is left has to be burnt. What kind of dramatic change? Very. The Meshech Chochma establishes an important principle, and we're going to see how important this principle is. Not a translation. There are two words that mean no. One is al, and one is lo. I can say al, don't do this, or lo, don't do that. Yeah? What's the difference between al and lo? So he says, if you recall, a number of times in Sefer Bereshit, the word al usually comes, or may very often come, with the word no, please. Al no, please. When Avraham is sitting at the opening of his tent and he sees guests out there, but or he sees Arabs or dusty travelers on the road, and he wants to bring them into the house, but God is visiting him. So he turns to God and says, "God, al no, please don't leave. Please don't leave. I'll be right back." Yaakov says to Yosef, "Al no tigbereni b'mitzchayim. Please don't bury me in Egypt." Al and no very often come together. There's something soft about al. Please, please don't. Even if it doesn't say no, it's not the same kind of imperative as lo. Lo is no, yet. Absolutely not. That's what low is. Low titzach, low tinof, low tignof, low. Low is a divine imperative. Loi mitan aleph. That's what loi is. Al is what? Al mitan aleph. What Reb Meir Simcha is going to demonstrate is that it's most fascinating to see where the Torah uses al and where the Torah uses low. It says, lo, totidu mimenu adboka. Why? Why one al and why the other lo? Beautiful. When are they going to eat it? they're going to eat the Korban Pesach that night in Egypt, they're going to start long before midnight. I don't imagine they'll come home from shul about 6-7 o'clock. We'll sit down to the Seder, right? They're going to be finished eating the Korban Pesach by the time midnight arrives. If we're talking about something that's left over, that's by morning. The next pasuk is talking about something left over till morning, right? Till morning. That's after midnight. At the stroke of midnight, a dramatic change takes place in the relationship between God and the Jewish people. Up until midnight, they are living with faith and trust. God hasn't done yet what he has promised to do. They only have confidence that he's going to do it. He hasn't done anything yet. They have not yet become B'ni B'chodi Yisrael, my firstborn son Israel. They have not yet become the people of God. The truth is, they're not even beholden to him yet. But at the stroke of midnight, for all time, the relationship between God and the Jewish people changes. I have now begun the process of redeeming you. I've done what I promised. I've made you B'ni B'chodi Yisrael. You are my firstborn son Israel. Egypt is throwing them out. From the moment of midnight and on, God has the right to make demands of Klal Yisrael, divine imperatives. You have moved from the province and the domain of Paro, and you are now in the domain of God. God has acquired the Jewish people, and he acquires them as his servants at the stroke of midnight. Therefore, the halacha of not eating it raw or cooked, God can say, listen, I'll do me a favor, please don't. I can't make demands on you. I can't make any demands on you. But in the next pasuk where we're talking about something, a halacha of after midnight, then I am the divine decider. I am the one who tells you what to do. Lo totidu mimenu al bokeh. Don't leave anything over until morning. I'll give you another few examples when you see how fascinating this is. In Parashat Kedoshim, in Sefer Vayikra, there is a pasuk that says, Al tifnu el ha'elilim, do not turn toward idolatry. Ve'elohei ma'secha, and a god, a graven image, lo taselecha, don't make unto you. In the same pasuk we have an al and a lo. With regard to turning toward idolatry, it says, Al, don't turn toward idols. With regard to making a graven image, it says, Elohei ma'secha, a molten image, lo taselecha, don't make unto you. Says the Meshech Chachma, why one al and the other lo? Simple. The second part of the pasuk is talking about making an image, physical act. God can say, don't do it. The first part of the pasuk is talking about thoughts of heresy, thoughts that are blasphemous, thoughts that represent idolatry or a rejection of God. Man is not the master of his thoughts. Thoughts can zoom through the mind without us having any control over it. All that God can say is, when a thought of that sort occurs, you do something. Study Torah. Find out the answer to your question. Al tifnu el ha'elilim is talking about, don't turn intellectually or emotionally toward them. That cannot come as the result of a divine imperative. Don't you dare do it. I can't help it. There are thoughts that run through our minds. A terrible tragedy occurs, and I think, where is God? Is there a God? I can't help that. But I have to do something about it. So where it deal with the emotions, God says, oh, please, don't think that way. If you think that way, do something about it. But with regard to making something with your hands, the Bakashat, I tell you, don't you dare make a graven image. In later on in Sefer Vayikra, it's so fascinating. I know what happens after I say this. I said it a number of years ago. You are going to become obsessed with al and lo. You're going to become al and lo nuts. Wherever you see an al or a lo, you're going to try to figure out, why does the Torah say al or why does the Torah say lo? And that's great. This illness usually lasts about 6-7 months, and it's an extremely blessed one. In Parashat Bahar, it says if your brother is going to fall economically, he's in serious trouble, Bechazaktabo, you should give him strength, and ger v'toshav, even the ger, the stranger who lives in your midst, the toshav, one who dwells here, not necessarily Jewish, the chayimach, he should be able to live with you. Make it possible for him to live with you. Al tikach me'ito neshech v'tarbit. Don't take interest from him. If you want to see this, it's in chapter 25 in Vayikra. The pasuk is so fascinating. Chapter 25, pasuk 36. And then in the very next pasuk it says, "As et kas b'chol lo titein lo b'neshech." Your money, you should not give him for interest. In pasuk 36 it says, "Please don't take interest." In pasuk 37 it says, "Lo, don't take interest." What's going on over here? Same thing. One pasuk al, the other pasuk lo. Says the Meshech Chachma, talking about two different people. The first pasuk is talking about the ger, the stranger, the guy who lives in your midst. That guy, if he lends you money, he can take interest. It doesn't make economic sense when God says, listen, he's living in your midst. I want you to be nice to him. So therefore, all that God says is, I know it's difficult. It doesn't even make much sense. Please, don't take interest from him. Because remember, he can charge you interest. Because he's a guy, he doesn't have a prohibition on interest. God says, he's living in your midst. He's also created in the image of God. Deal with him the way you would deal with your brother. Please don't take interest from him. The next pasuk is talking about taking interest from a Jew. Your brother, don't you dare take interest from him. I'll give you another fascinating example in Parshat B'Shalach. So you're going to come to Parshat B'Shalach, you can listen to the Kriyat HaTorah, and you're going to find that God says about the man. The man, the bread that comes down from heaven. So first, twice. One place it says, Al Totiru, don't leave it over until morning. Don't leave it over till morning. And then Shabbos, Al Yetzi Ishmi Mekomo, let nobody go out of his place to go find them. Go find the man. There isn't going to be any man on Shabbos. I'm going to give you a double on Friday. Here is another principle. There are things that are so self-evident, it's not even necessary to make it an imperative. What's going to happen if you leave the mon over until morning? It's going to be ruined. It's going to become decayed and rotted. So I have to tell you, don't you dare leave it over till morning. God says, don't be silly. What are you talking about? Don't leave it over till morning. There's no necessity for an imperative to say, Chas v'shulam, you dare not leave it over till morning. What's going to happen? You'll see. You don't believe me? Leave it over till morning and see what's going to happen. Or, Torah says, please don't go out of your camp to look for it on Shabbos. God has to say, divine imperative, Isser Chomer. Maybe put up signs all around the camp. Isser Chomer, signed by the Badatz or the Kehillah Kedosha, the Yerushalayim, you're not allowed to go out to look for man on Shabbos. You don't have to do that. Because what's going to happen if you're going to go out and look for it? It's not there. So God doesn't have to say, lo, don't go out. Do yourself a favor, do me a favor, Brenishkin Kop. Don't go out looking for it. You're not going to find it. It's not going to be there. It's not going to be there. So the... Maybe another example. Give one more example. It says when you sell something, this is also in Vayikra, in that same Parshat Bahar, when you sell something to your friend or you buy something, Al tonu ish et achiv. Don't cheat. Don't cheat your brother. What are you talking about? The car. It goes like a dream. It has 500,000 kilometers, it has another 1,000,000 kilometers. What are you talking about? The best buy you can get. And we know, of course, the seller, of course, knows that the car is just about finished. Can't cheat somebody. You have to be honest in business dealings. Al tonu ish et achiv. Don't cheat one another. Then right afterwards, there's a pasuk that says, V'lo tonu ish et amito. You shall not. Loy mitan olav. You shall not cheat one another. Why the switch from al to low? according to the Gemara, the first pasuk where it says al is talking about cheating in business, real cheating in business. So there the Torah says al. Now don't be silly. You're going to start cheating, you know what will happen? Before you know it, they're going to cheat you back and you won't even know that you were cheated. Cheating, dishonesty, being immoral, unethical, unconscionable in business is a two-way street. If you're going to set the example of being dishonest, before you know it, the whole society is going to be dishonest. Al, do yourself a favor. Do yourself a favor, don't cheat one another. The second passage that says, Lo tonu ishata mito, the Gemara says, that's talking about onaat dvarim. To grieve and to hurt somebody with words. I can cheat and hurt somebody by robbing him. Robbing him blind, he doesn't even know that he's getting a lemon. There's another way that I hurt and grieve people, and that's by saying something that's cutting and biting. So here what? He's going to hurt me back. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. There the Torah says, Lo, don't you dare ever hurt a fellow human being verbally. Don't dare assault him. Which brings us, of course, back to the point that we really wanted to make here. The difference between al and lo in psukim, in the psukim here in Parashat Bo, are evidence. They're just, it's fascinating what an indication they are of the dramatic transformation that's taken place in the relationship between Klal Yisrael and God. Before midnight, God can only ask, please don't eat it raw, don't eat it cooked. After midnight, then the Jewish people have become his people. And therefore, he can demand. Maybe just a final example that's brought by that Meir Simcha. The two women come before Shlomo HaMelech to ask about the baby. To whom does the baby belong? So he says, well, bring a sword and let's cut the baby in half. So the real mother says, Tnula, give her the baby. V'hameit al t'mituhu. Please, don't kill him. Shlomo HaMelech issues the order, Lo t'mituhu, don't kill him. Obviously the difference is clear. The mother can only beg, plead, importune. Please, please don't kill him. Shlomo HaMelech is king, he gives the order. Don't kill the child. I want to demonstrate one final dramatic change in the consciousness of Klal Yisrael. And I don't know, it occurred to me this week, on Shabbos, they usually see me learning the Sedra of the following week. There must be many people who think he doesn't know what Sedra it is. I'm learning Bo. I mean, I'm always trying to keep up with myself. I know what Sedra it is, even though sometimes I get confused. By this afternoon, I'm already going to be working on the Shalach. Who knows what I'll open up on Shabbos. I saw a Rashi that shook me. And what shook me is, why didn't the Rashi shake me years ago? In Parashat Bo, this is classic gold, if I must say so. It's not a plan, just the truth. I just have to say the truth. I like this. Take a look in Perek 13. I'm going to do a one-line Rashi. Chapter 3. 13, Pasuk 3. Vayomer Moshe el Ha'am, Moshe said to the nation, Zachorat Hayom Hazeh, remember this day. Asher Yitzatam im Mitzrayim, Beit Avodim, that you went out of Egypt from the house of slavery, Ki Bechozek Yad Hotzi Hashem Etchem Mizeh, because with a strong hand God took you out of this place, V'lo Yeyochel Chometz, you shouldn't eat Chometz. Hayom, Atem Yotzim, today you're going out, Bechodesh Ha'aviv, in the month of the spring. V'hoya, and it will come to pass, Ki Yeviyacha, this is the Pasuk. And it comes to pass when God is going to bring you to the land of the Kenani, the Chiti, the Amori, the Chivi, the Yevusi, Asher Nishba La'avotecha La'atet Lach, that he swore to your fathers to give to you, Eretz Zavat Chalav Devash, a land flowing with milk and honey, V'avadeto Tavoda Hazot B'Chodesh Hazeh, you should do this service in this month. Says Rashi, Eretz Zavat Chalav Devash, a land flowing with milk and honey. says Rashi, Cholav Zav min ha'izim, the milk comes, flows from the goats, V'hadvash, and honey Zav flows from the tamarim u'minat ha'enim, from the dates and from the figs. A very harmless Rashi. That's what the Gemara says. That's the meaning of Zavas Cholav Advash, that there's such abundance, that the goats are giving so much milk, and the dates and the figs are so luscious, the nectar just comes out of it. This is not an innocent Rashi, by no stretch of the imagination, and I'll tell you why. In Parashat Shemot, when God appears to Moshe at the burning bush, twice he says to him, behold, I'm going to take you out of Egypt, and I'm going to bring you to the land of the Canaanite, the Chiti, the Chivi, the Yebusi, Eretz Zavat Cholav Advash. Twice the Pasuk says, I'm bringing you to a land flowing with milk and honey. You know already what my question is. Why didn't Rashi make the comment about what the definition of Zavat Cholav Advash is? Why doesn't he do it immediately the first time that description appears in Torah, when Moshe Rabbeinu was standing at the snare? Why doesn't God tell him Eretz Zavat Cholav Advash? And God tells him that, so Rashi should tell us, you know what Zavat Cholav Advash means? That the milk comes from the goats, and the honey comes from the figs and the dates. It's chapter 3 in Shemot, Pasuk 8, V'eidet lahatzilo mi'av mitzrayim u'lahalotom in haaretz ahil, eretz tovo rokovel eretz Zavat Cholav Advash. I'm going to take them out of that land to a land flowing with milk and honey. And we come aknari achite amedi abrizi b'achive b'yevusi. That's once. Later on in Parashat Shemot, they're still at the snare. Chapter 3, Pasuk 17, for Omar, God said, I said, I will bring you out of the slavery of Egypt, the affliction of Egypt, to a land flowing with milk and honey. That's twice that Rashi doesn't say it. If Rashi remained silent until now, there has to be good reason. There has to be good reason. Some of you may recall, I'm not going to go into it, some of you may recall a shiur that I gave last year on Parashat Vayigash. You know, there, you can get the tape, of course. That was the commercial. Hashidur Hazem Emuman. All right. Where I asked a similar question, and I give credit where credit is due, was a question that my wife asked me, and she is the one that set the pattern for a certain approach that I take to Rashi. We were then flying from New York to Pittsburgh for a wedding, and I was reading Time magazine, and she was learning Chumash, and it was Parashat Vayigash, and in Parashat Vayigash, Yosef, after he reveals himself to his brothers, he says, "Maharu va'alu el avi, hurry and go up to my father." Says Rashi, why did he use the term Alu, go up? Because Eretz Yisrael gevoah mikol haaretzot, Eretz Yisrael is higher than all of the lands. So my wife says to me, what's going on? I mean, the term up and down has been used a number of times to describe the journey to or from Eretz Yisrael. Why does Rashi say it here? Then I began to look. She was absolutely right. Beginning from Parshat Lech Lecha, Avram comes to the land, and there's a famine in the land. By Yedad Avram Mitzrayim, he went down to Mitzrayim. When he's finished with the Mitzrayim experience, it says by Yal he went up to Eretz Yisrael. Why didn't Rashi over there tell us? Why does it say down or up? Because Eretz Yisrael Gevor Mikol Haaretzot. In Parsha Vayigash itself, what's the first part of the Parsha? Yehuda speaking to Yosef. He says, we came down to Egypt. We went up to our father. You said we cannot come down again unless we bring Binyamin. We told our father we can't go down. We went up, we came down, we can't go up, we can't go down. Time and time again, up, down, and down, up, and Rashi never makes any comment. Why doesn't Rashi say? The first time, when it says, Vayedad Avram the time Avram went down to Egypt, Rashi should have said, Eretz Yisrael, Gavol Mikol Haaretzot, Eretz Yisrael is higher than all other lands. And then we'd understand whenever in Tanakh it's going to say, up, down, down, up, with regard to the journey to or from Eretz Yisrael, we'd know exactly why. Why does Rashi wait till that pasuk in Vayigash, when Yosef says, Maharu Hari Valu Elavi, as I said, Rashi, genius. He was waiting for the most significant moment of all. There's one Jew in the whole world who's living in Chutz Laretz, and that one Jew who's living in Chutz Arutz has become the great success story of all time. The second in command of the mighty Egyptian empire. He's the father and patron to Paro. He's the ruler of all of Egypt. And Yosef HaTzadik instinctively, when he says to his brothers, Maharu, hurry to my father. He's in such a hurry, he should have said simply, Maharu Elavi, hurry to my father. But no, Yosef realizes, Eretz Yisrael is Aliyah. Maharu Va'alu Elavi, hurry and go up to my father. When we hear that word coming out of Yosef, the great success story of all time, he made it big in the Gola, it's great in Chutz Laretz. But Yosef is the great Ohev Eretz Yisrael. When he says, Alu, that's meaningful. Rashi waited patiently through all of Bereshit. Every time he came to an up or a down, he said, no, I'm not going to write it here. I'm going to write it when it comes out of the mouth of Yosef. Rashi waited here. He did not explain Zavat Cholavit Vosh when God says it twice to Moshe at the snare. And I'll point out something else to you. Remember we learned last week, what's the beginning of Parashat Va'era? The four expressions of redemption, v'hotzeiti, v'hitzalti, v'lakachti, v'ga'alti, you know them all. The fifth one is, v'heveiti etchem al ha'aretz, and I will bring you to the land, ashenasati et yadi, that I lifted my hand in a promise, in an oath, to give it to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and I'm going to give it to you. Here he doesn't describe the land as Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Why isn't it described here as a land flowing with milk and honey? This is the third time that they're told that they're going to be brought to Eretz Yisrael. And so we have two questions. Why does Rashi wait to explain Zavat Chalav Udvash until here in Parshat Bo? Why doesn't God say it to Moshe in Parshat Ve'era? You know what Rashi is telling us? Simple. He wants to point out the transformation that has taken place in the consciousness of Klal Yisrael. You would have described to them the beauty of Eretz Yisrael before, they wouldn't have listened to you. They wouldn't even have heard it. If it would have gone in one ear, it would have gone out the other ear, and chances are it would never have gone in one ear. Hain, if Israel doesn't listen to me because of Kotzer Ruach Vavoda Kosher, they're so enslaved, they're so beaten down, they don't hear me. There's no point in describing to them the beauty of Eretz Yisrael. It won't mean anything. They're so lost in the suffering, the torture of Egypt, it won't mean anything. When God says it to Moshe at the snare, it's a communication to Moshe. Moshe, he understands. Till now. And in Parashat Ve'era, at the beginning, there God is telling him what to say to the Jewish people. So he says, V'hotzeiti, v'itzalti, v'lagalti, v'lakachti, v'heveiti, and I will bring you to the land. But he does not describe the land. Too early. They're not ready to understand that. In Parashat Bo, what is he saying over here? Moshe says to them an interesting pasuk: Hayom atem yotzim, today you're going out the Chodesh Ha'aviv, and it will come to pass when God is going to bring you to the land of the Canaanite, the Chiti, the Amori, the Chivi, the Yevusi, that he swore to your fathers. First of all, this is the first time that Klal Yisrael ever hears the description of Eretz Yisrael as Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. We heard it already in Parashat Ve'era, but this is the first time it's being communicated to them. And it's Moshe who's communicating it to them. And why? Because he knows that God already described it that way. But God never wanted him to say it to Klal Yisrael because they wouldn't appreciate it. They wouldn't understand it. You can't talk to them about the beauty of the land while the people are enslaved. But today you're going out. Your conscience, your mind, your neshama, you're different, you're open, freedom. Now you can hear it. Now you can listen. Now we've already begun the journey. Now you want to know what to look forward to. I'm telling you what to look forward to. You're coming to an Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. I believe that over here, the fact that Rashi describes Zavat Chalav Udvash here, what he really wanted is that you should notice precisely what I'm telling you. You should notice. Rashi must be having so much nachas from this. Rashi must be having nachas. This is really the pshat. That's exactly what I have in mind. Why do you think I didn't explain to you Savat Chalav Etvash back there in Parshat Shemot? Why didn't I explain it to you? Because this is a message that Klal Yisrael has to hear. And it's Moshe who's saying it to them, and he's saying it to them only now that they've got out. Because once they, now they can hear, now they're ready. The journey has begun. They want to look forward to it. They're ready to hear it, they're ready to hear it. We know, of course, there are times that you can talk to people about the land flowing with milk and honey, on the Hechnisht. They don't listen. They can't hear. For all sorts of reasons. It may be the materialism of a world out there, they can't hear it. They can't hear it. You can be enslaved to materialism without being in Mitzrayim. You can be enslaved to a materialistic lifestyle. Lifestyle, you know, that makes it sound very nice. There are all kinds of lifestyles. You can be enslaved even within the great freedom and independence of the world out there. Only the one who is Yotzei B'Chodesh Ha'aviv is able to hear, he's able to assimilate, he's able to understand. And Rashi knew that this is the precise moment. Now you're going to hear it. Eretz Zavat Chalav Edvash. That's why he defines it and describes it here. So what we have done is we have traced the dramatic changes that take place in Paro, and on the other hand, the great changes that are taking place in Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael move from a passive witnessing community and they become an active one. They become active to the extent that they already have developed the great hope and anticipation that they are able to celebrate the exodus from Egypt and freedom. They're celebrating, can you imagine celebrating July 4th on July 3rd, 1776? That's what they were doing. They were celebrating independence and freedom even before it came. And it's only after they move out of Mitzrayim, as they are going out, only now can they truly look to the future. They can assimilate and understand and comprehend and most probably become full of joy thinking about that Eretz Zavat Chalav Edvash. As we said, as Paro goes from freedom to bondage, Klal Yisrael goes from bondage to freedom. He goes further, deeper into the depths and the darkness of sin as Klal Yisrael comes out to light. V'hoyah or l'chol b'nei Yisrael, g'mosh otav.